This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hey, Jamie.
Yes, Caitlin.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for giving me a job as your handmaiden.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I just want to let you know, I'm definitely not trying to trick you and steal your fortune or anything like that.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess while we're on the topic, I wanted to let you know that I'm definitely not three steps ahead of you, what with the trick. And I'm tricking you based on your trick. And your trick is actually a whole distraction. And it doesn't matter because we're going to fall in love. At the end, all the tricks cancel each other out, and we're gonna go on a boat.
I love that for us.
Good for us. Yeah, I'm gonna seem like I've never been outside, but here's the twist: I have been outside a couple times.
Okay,
at least.
All right. Well, I love that we're learning so much about each other.
We're in love. What can you do?
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast.
Perfect intro, as usual.
Amazing. We nailed it. My name is Caitlin Durante.
My name is Jamie Loftus, and this is our podcast where we look at your favorite movies, your least favorite movies, movies that you don't know how to feel about, using an intersectional feminist lens.
And we use the Bechdel test simply as a jumping off point to initiate a larger conversation. And the Bechdel test is a media metric created by queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test. And it has many versions, and the one that we are using these days.
And we also have been finessing this formula. We've been finessing our little twist on it for a half a decade at this point.
It's true. The metric that we are using, the caveats, if you will, mm-hmm. are that a movie has to have two characters of any marginalized gender mm-hmm. who have names. They must speak to each other about something other than a man. Mm-hmm. And ideally, their conversation is meaningful, plot relevant, not just a throwaway exchange of dialogue.
Or maybe it's, in the case of this movie, a deceitful exchange. I love a good deceitful exchange.
You know what? It's allowed.
It's allowed.
And then something that we should bring up more often, but it's especially relevant for a movie like this, is that the test originally appearing in Alison Bechdel's Dykes to Watch Out For in 1985. The context for that was that Alison Bechdel's characters, who are queer women, would watch movies and pay attention to if the female characters in the movies they're watching speak to each other? And if so, do they talk about things besides a man? Because if so, then Alison Bechdel's characters could ship them together and pretend that they were lesbians in the movie that they're watching. So that is the origins of the Bechdel test.
Yeah, speaking to the piss poor representation of any queer people in movies at the time the comic was published back in 85.
Right. And then for a movie like this, no shipping required because the characters do that for you.
It's canon.
Yes. So the movie that we're talking about today is The Handmaiden. Mm-hmm. And we have a guest joining us. She's a pal of ours. She's a cybersecurity engineer. It's Soyoung Chan.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So we're interested in what is your relationship, your history, your general impression of The Handmaiden?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty wild from start to finish. these types of movies don't really come out that much from South Korea because Korea is a pretty conservative country still. Mm-hmm. So this was a big shock when it came out featuring two lesbian women, and that never happens. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was overall really, really good, really new and groundbreaking for Korea. So that's mm-hmm. what I thought. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Ooh, I can't wait to talk about it more. Jamie, what about you?
I hadn't seen this movie yet, and it rocked my world. I really like movies that really keep you on your toes like this, where I guess if you haven't seen this movie, I would recommend honestly watching it, because listening to us, like, some movies I feel fine spoiling for our listeners, but this movie, I'm so glad I didn't know any of the twists going in, because sometimes I'll go into a movie being like, I've seen it all, and then it turns out, guess what, I like half of my notes from the first half of the movie I had to like highlight and being like, just kidding, I am the fool. Like, they got my ass. Like, it's so tightly written, and I just, yeah, this was my first time. I've seen it twice. I feel like this is a movie that really delivers on a rewatch. Mm-hmm. And I just really enjoyed it. Holy shit. I am just not as smart as this movie. I'm not operating on this level, and it was a pleasure to be in a world where I was like, oh yeah, I would have, I don't know what would have happened to me if I existed in this world. I would have just died, because everyone is operating, like, everyone's playing 4D chess the entire movie. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Caitlin, what's your history of this movie?
Oh, gee whiz. I saw it not right when it came out, but I remember there being buzz around it because it was released in the US sometime, I think, in the back half of 2016. Mm-hmm. And then it won the Oscar for Best Movie Not in the English Language.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for like the 2016 Oscars. So I was like, ooh, all right, gotta see it.
Exciting.
So I was still getting Netflix DVDs at the time. So I took it upon myself to borrow, rent, or whatever, have Netflix send me a DVD. Mm-hmm. And I don't normally do this, but I watched the movie, and then as soon as it was over, I immediately watched it again. Because I was like, whoa, holy shit. I don't even want to process that. I just want to like rewatch it and just have a better understanding of what happened. Because, yeah, like you said, there's so many twists, there's so many layers, and so I've seen the movie, I think, like 6 or 7 times now.
Oh, wow.
And every time I watch it, I discover something new, or like notice like a new little clue, or like a bit of foreshadowing, or some like plant and payoff, or just like some detail that I had overlooked before. So yeah, it definitely holds up on a rewatch. The twists are so intricate that, or like some of the reveals are just like, I won't remember what happened. So like every time I rewatch it, it's like I'm seeing it for the first time. So I'm just like, whoa, and it's beautiful to look at. It's mesmerizing. Yeah, the story is so tightly written. I love this movie. So,
and the history behind the movie is also really interesting. I didn't know about like all the adaptation stuff going on in this movie, so I'm very excited. Ooh, to talk about it.
Yeah, I also, in preparation for this episode, watched the BBC, like, 2-episode miniseries.
Wow.
Fingersmith.
She's doing her homework. Okay.
Yes. Well, then I was also like, Sally Hawkins is in this. Paddington's mom is in this. Obviously, I have to watch it.
See, I always think of Sally Hawkins. I'm about to sound like I hate women. I'm like, she's the lady who had sex with the fish in the movie. I know that lady. But that was reductive, and I apologize. But she did have sex with a fish.
I mean, you're not wrong.
I'm not wrong, but I should remember the character's name. I just know it was Sally Hawkins.
Well, she's definitely Mrs. Brown in the Paddington franchise. Mm-hmm. So I did watch Fingersmith. And,
did you like it?
I did. So just some context for anyone who's not aware. This movie is based on a novel called Fingersmith by Sarah Waters that was published in 2002, I think. So obviously we did not read the book because we famously on this podcast do not read books.
It probably won't stop people from getting mad at us for not reading a book. But listen, the show is free. I don't know what to tell you.
But I did watch this adaptation, and probably like the second half of Fingersmith is pretty wildly different from the second half of The Handmaiden, where I like the ending of The Handmaiden way better. And I don't know if that's just because like I saw it first and my brain just works that way, where I'm like, well, the first thing I saw is the thing that I like better, because this happens all the time with me. But I don't know. I feel that it gives the characters more agency. Yeah, I like The Handmaiden better. I like the narrative choices that were made there. So
yeah, it's the rare movie where I feel like we're constantly complaining about how movies are long. But this movie is 2.5 hours long, and it does not feel 2.5 hours long, which is incredible, a miracle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Should I get into the recap?
Yeah. Yeah, let's do it. And okay. So you feel free to jump in at any time. It's a free for all.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, so the story takes place in Japanese-occupied Korea. So both Korean and Japanese are spoken by almost every major character throughout the movie. I believe we are in the 30s?
Yeah, that
although
was what
the
I...
decade wasn't super clear, but
I read in interviews that, yeah, it's supposed to be the 30s.
Okay, cool. The story is divided into three parts. Part one, we meet Suki, a pickpocket, a forger. She's like a common thief. We also meet a Korean man from a low class who is masquerading as a Japanese nobleman. He's going by the name Count Fujiwara.
I kept calling him Count Olaf in my head because anytime someone introduces themselves as a count, I was like, okay, all counts are con men. This is a trend in media. All counts are lying about being a count. And they're always wearing a hat and lying. That's my knowledge of counts. And
I think that's canon.
Yeah. Does this count challenge that? He does not.
It's true. So he helps Suki get a job as a handmaiden to Lady Hidako. And he does this because he intends to seduce Lady Hidako, marry her, put her in, like, quote, a madhouse so that he can steal her fortune. And he needs Suki's help to do all this. So Suki, using a fake name, meets Lady Hidako and starts tending to her. She spends most of her days helping her uncle, Kazuki, with his rare books, which he collects and sells. And then he also hosts private events where Hidako does readings from the books for rich Japanese gentlemen.
Right. And the meaning of rare books is really stretched and challenged later.
Yeah.
Yes. Her uncle is... It becomes apparent pretty early on, and then even more apparent later on, that he is extremely creepy, and he's also trying to marry Hidako to get access to her fortune.
Also something that Count Olaf's trying to do all the
time.
Yes.
Oh, that's true.
Just a lot of Count Olaf connections here.
Oh my god, right.
Counts are always trying to marry people under false pretenses to get access to a fortune. I need to write a think piece about this.
Doesn't Count Olaf pretend to be those children's uncle too, or some family member?
He pretends to be a distant relative in order to adopt them. Oh, I mean, I didn't even put that together.
Wow. The count,
if anyone ever introduces them as a count, walk away. They're lying.
What's the story of the Count of Monte Cristo?
Oh.
I know I saw that movie, but...
No idea.
I feel like there's some deception involved there as well.
Count... Okay, this is not... The Count of Monte Cristo, is that related to the sandwich? Or is the sandwich a separate thing? Monte Cristo sandwich? Is Monte Cristo a place?
I think they're all...
Sorry, I was just born this morning.
I think they're all extremely, not only connected, but identical.
What is even in a Monte Cristo sandwich? You know what?
That's the one where there's ham and there's cheese and you like panini it and then there's like powdered sugar on top.
Wow.
Right?
That's always such a scam when someone makes a very simple sandwich sound extremely fancy and they're like, it's a Monte Cristo, it's $17. And then you get it, you're like, this is ham and cheese. How dare you?
Anyway, speaking of the Count.
Yes.
he gets to work on seducing Lady Heidegger under the guise of giving her painting lessons. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Suki and Hedeko are getting closer and they are clearly attracted to each other. Mm-hmm. And the further into the scam Suki gets of like helping the fake count marry Hedeko, the more Suki wants to back out. Mm-hmm. Especially after one night when Lady Hedeko wants Suki to teach her how to kiss so that she will be ready to kiss the count. Mm-hmm. And then they end up having very steamy sex. Mm-hmm. Suki has no choice but to keep going along with the scam, and the two of them run away. They travel with the count to Japan. Mm-hmm. The count marries Hedeko, and then he and Suki take Hedeko to be institutionalized. But wait a minute, turns out that the count and Hedeko had been the ones who were tricking Suki, and they send Suki to the institution.
I gasped.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
When Hedeko, at first I was like, what is going on? Because she hugs Suki, and then she walks backward really quickly, and I was like, what is happening? And then it was the twist.
Yeah.
But wait, there's more.
There's two more parts. So this is the beginning of part two. We learn what the real situation is with Lady Hedeko. Mm-hmm. She's not this like virginal, naive lady that we all thought she was. Mm-hmm. The books of her uncles that she does readings for are very pornographic. Something that he's been training her to do ever since she was a child. Which is
what?
Disgusting.
The fuck?
Yeah.
And this is something he's done with like other members of the family too, like with mm-hmm. her aunt as well.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing.
Yes. So when the count first meets her, he realizes that he would never be able to seduce her. So then he forms a different plan, which is to collaborate with her, take her away from this place and set her free, and then they will split her fortune. And then it's her idea to find a handmaiden and send her to the institution under her name. Mm-hmm. So then a lot of the same story beats play out that we've seen before, but this time through Hedeko's point of view, with like Suki arriving and tending to her and convincing her that she's in love with the count. But then eventually, because Hedeko and Suki are falling in love, Hedeko also wants to back out of the plan.
Right.
And then finally, the two of them reveal to each other that they have been tricking each other. So
that scene is so good, but scary, but good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where Lady Hedeko is about to take her own life. She's about to hang herself. And then Suki catches her, and everyone watching the scene has an anxiety attack of like, I hope that she has strong arms. And this whole scene it's really good. These two actors together are incredible.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
So now their new plan is to team up with each other against Count Fujiwara. And then right before they're about to run away, they also destroy the uncle's treasured book collection as basically a, like, fuck you, dude, gesture.
Yeah.
And then we realize that when Suki is taken to the institution, it's all part of the plan. So then part three is Suki escapes from the institution by lighting it on fire.
I was slightly confused about the logistics, but by that point in the movie, I was like, yeah, sure. She lights it on fire.
Yeah,
sure.
I believe it. Meanwhile, Hideko drugs the count, escapes, and meets up with Suki. They flee and get on a ferry to Shanghai. Mm-hmm. And then the count has been captured and brought back to the uncle's estate, where the uncle tortures him. And then the count smokes a couple cigarettes laced with mercury, which poisons the air and kills both the men. And then we cut back to the ferry, where Suki and Hideko have more steamy sex.
Yes.
And that's how the movie ends. So let's take a quick break, and then we will come back to discuss.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
And we're back.
Where do we, Caitlin, I'm genuinely curious, just to start, what is different about the ending of the BBC adaptation? Because I know that the largest adaptation change is obviously changing the setting, and I think the time period was shifted as well. I think it was like Victorian England to 1930s Japan and Korea. But what is different about like the plot points of the ending?
So yeah, the first half plays out basically the same, but in Fingersmith, the two women never collaborate. They never say, oh, you're tricking me, I was tricking you, wow, let's team up together and take down these male oppressors. That does not happen. Instead, the handmaiden character ends up in the institution and then stays there for a while, does still escape. Meanwhile, the lady character, like, is taken to London after this marriage, and she keeps trying to escape, and they're like, no, we still have to get your fortune from you. So she eventually is able to run away and goes to one of, like, the book collectors that her uncle knows, but then he, like, turns her away, so she has to go back to the home base of all the, the thief house, basically, in London, which, by the way, the sort of like matron character is played by Imelda Staunton, who is, of course, Aunt Lucy from Paddington.
Okay. I'm with you.
So there's a lot of Paddington connections in Fingersmith. And then that, like, matriarch character is like, hey, royal lady person, by the way, you were switched at birth with this handmaiden lady, and so she's the actual lady, and you're a pet. I think, maybe I'm getting that totally wrong, because things got also very confusing at that part.
The handmaiden is better, is what I'm hearing.
Right. Yeah, so there's some, like, switched at birth scandal.
You can't introduce switched at birth at the end. What is it, this fourth grade?
And then, so the count guy, who they call, whose name is like the gentleman in Fingersmith, comes around at some point and gets murdered by unclear which person it was. It was either like the lady or the Imelda Staunton character. But Imelda Staunton's character takes the blame for it, and then she is hanged. So that sort of, now that all these people are dead, she goes back to her, like, estate with all the books. And then Sally Hawkins, like, the handmaiden character, comes back, and they sort of, like, reconcile.
Okay.
So the huge difference is that there's never a team up. There's never, like, a co-conspirator, like, let's take the men down kind of thing.
They
just sort of, like, have to forgive each other. And then there's some, like, class stuff of, like, you're not who you think you are. And it's also kind of confusing. So that's Fingersmith.
It sounds interesting but long. I like this better.
Okay,
well, thank you for sharing that. I wasn't aware how much the source material deviated from this adaptation.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. Or, I mean, again, because we haven't read the book, who knows what happens there? Who knows how much that BBC adaptation deviated from the original source material? But The Handmaiden is pretty drastically different in the second half of it from Fingersmith, the BBC series.
Got it.
Yeah. So, yeah, and because of that, one of the things I like about this movie so much is that it's a story about men trying to exploit women and pit women against each other, which doesn't work because the women talk to each other. And then they're like, wait a minute, these men are trying to fuck us over. So they instead team up and punish their, like, again, the male oppressors. And then they get together and they live happily ever after.
God, I hope so.
Or at least happily on the ferry.
They at least have an amazing cruise.
So as you started to talk about So Young, in terms of, like, this being a pretty groundbreaking film for South Korean cinema in terms of its, like, queer representation. Yeah, just curious if you have any other thoughts on that or...
Yeah. Because, you know, queer representation is just, it's not, there's not a lot in Korean media and stuff like that, even in, you know, songs and stuff. And while it's still, while it's changing and people are becoming a lot more open to it, it's still not on the forefront like it is in America or, you know, other countries. So this was a, you know, this was a pretty big deal for not even, it's not even like two gay men, because that would have been still more something that you would see, but two women, that is unheard of. So this was, yeah, this was pretty groundbreaking in that way.
And I appreciate it. I saw, like, I guess mixed reception of the sex scenes and how they were filmed and framed. And I'm interested to talk about that as well. But I did appreciate that, like, this movie is not shy at all about what it's about and about this, like, intense sexual connection that these two women have, because I feel like we, I mean, even in covering other movies on this podcast, you know, very often when there is a relationship between two women, you get a fade to black situation, or you don't get the sex scene that appears in many PG-13 movies between a man and a woman. And so I was, yeah, pleasantly surprised to see, I was like, oh, we're getting sex scenes. That's exciting. I'm very pro-sex scene. Yeah. That's,
especially, like, and this would have been more common in at least, like, older American movies, but I just remember that episode that we did on Fried Green Tomatoes, where the source material, like, more explicitly makes it clear that the characters are queer, but then the movie, because it's, like, a movie from the 90s, not even suggests it. It's just like, they're friends.
Right.
They're friends who don't kiss each other.
They're like, they're friends and they live together for such a long time.
Which, based on how you described, like, the history of queer representation in South Korean cinema so young, you might expect there to be more of a, like, coding of, like, that relationship, even if, like, the two characters, like, do team up and, like, screw over the men, that the precedent was set, it sounds like, to not get very explicit about the nature of their relationship. So the fact that we do, it is very explicit, and we do see steamy sex scenes, which, again, we'll talk about, but yeah, I was like, I thought that was really cool, because I did a little bit of just kind of, I'm by no means an expert in Korean media and certainly not in, like, queer representation of it, but there is a very helpful Wikipedia, our favorite scholarly journal, page specifically about queer representation in Korean media, and that how, according to two scholars, Pilho Kim and C. Colin Singer, there are three pretty distinct waves of queer representation in Korean cinema, where there's, like, an invisible age from 1945 to 1997, where there was, like, minimal, very minimal LGBTQ plus representation in film, but those films were, like, relegated to the sidelines, like, they didn't get publicity, they were not mainstream, most people didn't see them, they, like, flew under the radar. And then there was the camouflage age from 98 to 2004, where representation grew during that period, but queer characters and themes were still sidelined and overshadowed by more heteronormative characters and themes. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the blockbuster age from 2005 to the present, where cultural acceptance of queer people and queer communities in South Korea, as well as queer representation in media, has just kind of, like, been on the rise and been more tolerated and accepted. So, which, like, doesn't sound that unlike the trend of queer representation in American Hollywood cinema, to be honest.
Yeah, that's true. It's just a little slower, a little more behind, right? Yeah.
Another trip that I really liked that this movie, because we've been covering a number of queer movies recently, and I think, oh, it was in our Portrait of a Lady on Fire episode where we discussed the trope that it's also a very white trope ordinarily, but when there is a period piece with a lesbian couple, that it's all very doomed. It's all very, like, it never ends well for the couple. The couple never is able to survive the adversity, which is in some ways at odds with many historical examples, but that is the trend that movies have taken. And so when I learned this was a period piece, I was like, oh no, are we going to get another, you know, doomed queer couple that, and we don't, they win, like they yep. win. And yeah. I mean, it was, I guess it does kind of demonstrate how going for scraps we still have to be at times, but I was like, their love survives. They overcome the adversity. It's not like, you know, an ending where they're just like, well, I wonder what could have been. Like, they're on the damn boat having sex. Mm-hmm. I was thrilled that they ended up together at the end. And because it's, yeah, in period pieces especially, I feel like that is kind of rare.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it legit shocked me, given the historical context of the movie, because, you know, during that time it was like a lot of people died, so it wouldn't have been strange to kind of see that ending. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it was a happy ending, I mean, that was amazing. I was like, absolutely, I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and the catharsis of, like, the two men dying, cut to two women just like putting jingle bells in their vaginas and having a ball.
I guess that's one way to put it.
Literally, no pun intended, having a ball. And just...
Oh God, there were moments where I like, this movie is just straight up smarter than me in certain ways where I was like, oh yeah, like I know that the bell, I was like, the bell is a metaphorical object. I can pick up on that much. And so when they're fucking each other with the bells, I'm like, this means something. I don't know what, but definitely something. It's a metaphorical thing. And I totally understand.
Yeah. I don't know what the bells are a metaphor for, but I feel like I don't need to know.
I don't know. Every time I'm just like, it's a metaphor for .. patriarchy. Don't actually really know.
I think the bells, they were in one of the books that,
yeah,
the lady she read. I think they're just kind of like, oh, I'm gonna reclaim it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not part of this weird creepy whatever thing that I'm doing for my uncle. It's like our love thing. That's what I thought. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, because it's like used as a weapon at one point. And okay, maybe I do understand.
Oh, but those are a different set of metal balls that are used, yeah, like as a...
Okay, then I'm lost again.
Yeah, I think that was stones.
Those weren't the bells? Okay.
No.
They look similar, but no, but you're right, So-young, where she was, because it's this difference of she's being forced against her will to read these stories solely for the sake of the pleasure of all of these men.
Right.
And then when we actually see her use those toys, materials, the items,
yeah, the bells,
the bells. Now it's like they're on her terms, and she's not doing it for these creepy men. She's doing it for herself. So it's like a nice, just symbolic thing. I also noticed in that scene, when she's reading about, because that's the only scene, I think, where she's doing a reading from one of those books that does involve two women. Mm. And we see her, like, pat her little handkerchief, like, pat down her, like, perspiration, as if to say, mm-hmm, yeah, wow, that actually got me excited. Because of all the other scenes where she's doing readings about, like, a penis going into a vagina, she's just like, not interested. Do not care.
And a penis going into a vagina in a pretty mean way most of the time. Like they're very unpleasant stories that all these, yeah, guys are getting extremely aroused by. It's all like, I mean, I guess that is like so much of what comes up in the movie is like the men of this story policing and controlling the women in their lives and controlling their bodies, sexually controlling their bodies in terms of like Lady Hideko is literally like trapped in this castle, kind of Princess Peach style. Mm-hmm. And it's like about the extreme control of women's bodies and an attempt to control their minds, which doesn't succeed. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's so, and then also in the case of the uncle, this really volatile nature of like repeated intimidation of his wife, who eventually takes her own life, and his niece.
But no, it's implied that,
oh, sorry,
he kills, yes, her, but it's right, played off as though she killed herself.
But in any case, like it repeatedly like instilling them with fear and threats. And then when they respond to that, they're framed as hysterical in this very, I mean, I guess you're like, well, it's the 1930s. Of course that is happening. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting seeing it framed the way it was, where it was like, even with that deception that they're like, oh, she took her own life, you know, because she was, you know, she was suffering from something that we don't really know what was going on, when it's like so clear what is going on, mm-hmm, in this house. where women are just brutalized, and I don't know. I mean, it's really brutal in some sections of this movie, to the point where, you know, when the count and the uncle kind of get their comeuppance at the end, you're like, thank God.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Especially with the reveal that the uncle has been basically grooming her since childhood.
Yeah.
To read this like erotic literature. That's straight up child sex abuse. And so when he keels over and dies, I was like, it's about damn time. Let's take another quick break and then we will be right back.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
And we're back.
We've referenced this already, but so Fingersmith was the inspiration for this story. It sounds like it deviates kind of significantly in the back half. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, pleasantly surprised, knowing nothing about the background of this movie, to find that it had been adapted by a text by a queer woman, mm-hmm. by a Welsh author named Sarah Waters, who wrote this in 2002. And I thought that I don't know, all the information on adapting this movie and adapting that story to Japan and Korea in this time period, I learned a lot. having gotten, you know, a piss poor American education, this period of history in Korea and Japan, I was not well versed in. I knew kind of the main bullet points, but learning more about the annexation of Korea and just the complete cultural erasure and colonialism that was going on at this time was not something that I was very well versed in, and it doesn't sound like it was something that Sarah Waters, a Welsh author, was very well versed in as well. And so there, we'll link this in the description, but it's just a very interesting adaptation story where Sarah Waters was at first not sure whether Park Chan-wook, who is the director of this movie and many other movies, he's kind of has a reputation for being a hyper masculine director. Like, he directs he directed Old Boy. Mm-hmm. He directed all these really male driven movies. And so at first she was like, does this make sense? And once they discussed collaborating, and he also wrote this script with a female co-writer, Chung Seo Kyung, who he's worked with a number of times over the years. So he had a female co-writer, and they proposed this time shift, and that was what got Sarah Waters on board. So I don't know. It's a really cool story of, and I feel like this time period and the setting like fit the story so effortlessly, and also kind of, I mean, based on what you're saying about the BBC adaptation, Caitlin, it sounds like it sort of expands the scope of what the story is able to explore, because it's, you know, not only is it examining class in a lot of ways, and it's like examining queerness and it's examining patriarchy, but it's also touching on this, you know, extreme period of colonialism and really aggressive cultural erasure in a way it sounds like the source material didn't, because of where and when it was set. So it's just a really interesting story.
Yeah, like I was like, turns out I know nothing about this period of history. Let me read the Wikipedia page.
I mean, it's just like in the US, we're just like not taught about this period of time at all. Yeah.
So this movie inspired me to like learn about it. So I did read the first several paragraphs of the Wikipedia page about it.
We'll link to some resources in the description as well. If you, like us, got a very limited, shitty education in the United States.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, like, I think one of the interesting things is, like, so the brutality of the men, right? The men were pretty terrible and they did pretty terrible things. Mm-hmm. But during this time, you know, there was a lot of anti-Japanese sentiment, obviously, because of what was happening. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting because these two men are very pro-Japanese, right? They want, you know, doing all these things. Mm-hmm. But they're Korean. And so it kind of showed the whole, you know, in my personal opinion, it showed a whole, like, oh, the Koreans who kind of betrayed, you know, our country, in a sense, were worse than the Japanese people who invaded our country. Mm-hmm. So I did find that that's a very interesting framing of that from Park Chan-wook, because, you know, this, during this time, it was such a, you know, it was obviously a bad time, but kind of that shined through, the very, you know, don't be this type of person during this horrible time in which, you know, these things happen. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's like that whole conversation they have where it's like a reveal later in the movie that the uncle has done the same thing that the count is in the middle of doing, which is,
yeah,
you know, saying they're Japanese when they are not, and being generally villainous. And but there's like that whole conversation they have where the uncle is talking about how he thinks that Korea is ugly and Japan is beautiful, and the count says, oh, you know, that's interesting, I've heard people say the exact opposite. And it's like the I don't know, I mean, and again, I'm not extremely educated in this period of history at all, but just even opening this story to make room for discussion about that. And it does seem like Park Chan-wook is making kind of a value judgment of these characters through their behavior outside of of the colonial history.
Yeah.
It's you know, I never want to see someone's fingers chopped off by like a paper cutter. I guess that's the end of the sentence. But you know, it's like if it had to happen to someone, I'm like, the count is terrible, and as the story goes on, you just realize more angles from which he is terrible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when they take his fingers off with a paper cutter, it's like, you know,
yeah,
okay, fine.
I'll allow it. Yeah, no, both the count and the uncle got what they deserved, as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, they're both abusers, they're manipulators. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see a scene where the count tries to sexually assault Hideko. These are awful, awful men.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that we see toxic male behavior being punished because they end up dying, because the women were very clever in their, like, orchestration of this scheme to get back at them. And I thought that was really cool to see. You often don't see toxic male behavior punished in movies. So yeah, I just appreciated that a lot.
Right. And it does seem like they really, I mean, both of those characters are leveraging the most dominant advantage they have, which is the fact that they're men. And it is, I feel like any, you know, any empathy you could generate for these characters who are to an extent in a really difficult situation as Korean men at this time of intense colonialism is completely undercut by the fact that they're taking it out on the women around them, the people who have less power than them, and elevating themselves at the expense of the people who have less power. And there were some like moments I found interesting with the Count where he says these things that sound so cutting and cruel, but you can sort of understand why he's saying them, even if you don't agree with it, where he's saying, you know, where I come from, it's illegal to be naive, and sort of referencing the fact that he's from the underclass and he's Korean. He's from a really oppressed group of people at this time. And so you can understand why he would say that. But what he's talking about is deceiving a Korean woman and throwing her in jail, essentially. And
it's almost like blaming her, and it's like, you shouldn't have trusted anybody ever.
Right.
It's all very fascinating. And the way that these really terrible men in the movie are punished for their like upholding of the patriarchy is very exciting to watch in a way that like doesn't really, I mean, it kind of happens in Fingersmith, but like, again, the major change that I really appreciate is the two women, like realizing that they're in love with the other, that kind of prompts them to admit what's going on. Then they're like, yeah, I'm upset that you tricked me, but also I was tricking you, so I can't be that upset. Right. But now that we know what the real situation is, let's team up. And now there's a third trickery happening against the Count. So
I love a movie with tricks. Oh. It's exciting.
Should we talk a little bit more about the sex scenes / the male gaze?
Yeah, let's get into
So like we mentioned, there have been mixed reviews about this, where some of the discussion around this film was how the movie deconstructs or transcends the male gaze. I think more based on the events of the story and how like these women team up and collaborate and take down the men rather than the sex scenes themselves, because other critics have been like, well, it is a movie about lesbians with some graphic sex scenes that were shot by a director and cinematographer who are both men, and these sex scenes are really long and quite graphic, and you know, there's still male gaze involved because of the people who are capturing this imagery and delivering it to an audience. And then other people were like, but what about the part of the movie where there's like a shot from the point of view of Hideko's vulva, where like we just see Suki like leaning in with her tongue out, about,
it's like she had a GoPro on her vulva. Is essentially the shot.
And so it's like, well, how can that be the male gaze when it's literally from the point of view of a vagina? And then so there's, you know, there's a lot of sides to this argument. I'm curious how the both of you feel about this.
I think the sex scenes were over the top. That's just my personal opinion. I think it was a lot and very graphic and almost like unnecessarily graphic, honestly. And I do agree, it's a male director, it's a male cinematographer, so there is a male gaze there, especially, I don't know the director, obviously, but just kind of like, how much do they really know about how the sex scene should go, you know, in like, in other LGBTQ movies? So I'll say, Yeah, that's like my main criticism. It's a lot. It's definitely almost too much. And I think if you didn't have it that graphic or whatever, it wouldn't have taken away from the story whatsoever.
Sure.
So I think, yeah, I think it was a little too much.
I wasn't sure. I mean, I was interested to read through all the different takes, and it's like, you know, if you loved the sex scene, that's great. I liked that there was a sex scene there. I didn't have any issue with that because I feel like, you know, very often, like we were talking about earlier, when there's a lesbian relationship, it's all very like wink, wink, fade to black in mainstream movies. Mm-hmm. But the scenes are very long. They're extremely long. The GoPro shot threw me.
We also get the same sex scene twice from like two different points of view, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, knowing that it was directed and filmed by men, I feel like kind of tells you what you need to know. And I was also interested in, this came from a Guardian profile of Sarah Waters, who wrote Fingersmith at the time The Handmaiden came out, and kind of like clarified. I was like, what is, so essentially what it says is in the book, which we're not going to read, but in the book, I guess, you know, Sarah Waters very often writes lesbian romances in her work, but a lot of what she's known for is just talking about women's bodies very frankly in a way that like incorporates things like sweat and like pubic hair and just things that are kind of glossed over in a lot of big movie sex scenes, and mm-hmm. present this very idealized version of what lesbian sex looks like. Mm-hmm. And that is like made clear in the story too, where, you know, like when Lady Hideko is reading this, you know, pornographic literature, they're referencing the vagina repeatedly as like hairless, smooth, like this mythic thing that those who have vaginas are like, okay, sure. Like,
it's somehow like pearly white, made of jade.
the jade gate, you know, and they're like folds of like gore. You're like, okay,
it
but
sparkles
also
sparkles and shimmers and
but there's also other stuff going on. And it seems like her work was kind of known for just like talking about bodies in that way that was like very sexual but also about actual bodies and not this like mythic view of what bodies mm-hmm. are. And I felt like the sex scenes in this movie didn't really meet that, where it still felt, even though the other side of that came across clearly, that it's like listening to her have to talk about this really unrealistic view of what a vagina looks like day after day is clearly wearing on her and is ridiculous and male gazey. The sex scenes, mm-hmm. I feel like, didn't really challenge that enough. I don't know. Mm-hmm. My personal opinion is that they were long.
Yeah, I'm like of two minds about it, where I think it's cool that we do get more of a foray into lesbian sex than you tend to see in mainstream movies, mm-hmm. just because of like our heteronormative society and so much phobia around queer sex. There's just been a tendency to shy away from it or skirt around it or just not feature it, especially because when it's lesbian sex, there is double the focus on female pleasure, mm-hmm. which is something that even in heterosex scenes and just, again, culture at large, the idea of female pleasure is terrifying to a large chunk of the population. So for there to be this emphasis on female pleasure in these sex scenes is cool and exciting.
Yeah.
But these sex scenes linger on for longer than we need. Yeah. And ultimately, they are, by the very nature of who is making this film, shot through the male gaze and interpreted through the male gaze, and even sort of the way in which the blocking of the sex scenes feels It's a lot. It's
I just knowing there was a man on the other side of the GoPro.
It feels
just like, okay.
It feels fetishy the way some straight men are like, oh yeah, lesbians getting it on.
Yeah.
That's so hot.
I agree. I feel like that is like another thing that it seems like, I mean, just based on doing basic, you know, research on this production team, that Park Chan-wook very often collaborates with the same group of people. And this is a cinematographer he works with a lot. But it's like, if, again, it's like we talk about this with male directors all the time of like, if you are dead set on adapting this story, then you need to be flexible in who you're working with. And you need to like really make sure you have people in the room who will just be able to speak to the experience, because otherwise there's going to be stuff that feels dissonant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did read an interview with the director in which he addresses these sex scenes. Mm-hmm. And it seems like his general intention was that he understood how like delicate of a thing this would be to shoot. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be as considerate and respectful to the actors as possible. Because that's always something where like, okay, these actors have to be naked in front of a bunch of people. They have to be physically close with another actor, simulating sex. And depending on different factors, this has the potential to be very uncomfortable for actors.
Right.
So I found this interview in which it seems like, you know, he did his very best, although some of the answers are funny, where he's like, that day we hired a woman to be the boom operator for that day on set. And it's like, well, is that the only circumstances where you would hire a woman to be your boom operator?
Ay.
But it seems like he was like fully aware of the situation. He wanted to make everyone as comfortable as possible. So there was like very minimal crew on set for those scenes. The DP and the camera operator were not on set, that they were using like a remote controlled camera.
I hope there was like an intimacy coordinator or something of that nature.
Ooh, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because so if any listeners are not aware, if a movie or TV production has a sex scene, ideally, they will hire what's called an intimacy coordinator, who is there to advocate for the well-being and safety of the actors who participate in sex scenes or just like kind of any other physically intimate scenes.
Yes.
Again, ideally, a set will have this person, but that's not always the case. And as far as whether or not an intimacy coordinator was present on this set, that did not get spoken of, so I am not sure.
I really hope so. Oh my God, if you're that naked, please have a person who's your advocate there. Mm. That is, I hope he just forgot to mention that person.
Yeah, that did not come up in the interview, but at least it sounds like he made an effort. I didn't find anything on how the actors felt about those scenes, about, you know, whether they were comfortable. I hope so. But yeah, it's also sort of like, okay, if you have to take so many leaps and bounds to make the shooting of this safe for the actors, it's also a question of like, okay, do I, like, does this absolutely need to happen this way? Or
I feel like there, I mean, in the erotic thriller genre in general, I feel like sometimes it's like, I don't know, I'm generally showing up for the thriller elements. And then if people are fucking, amazing. That's great. But that's not like what the bulk of the movie is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like those scenes were like, okay, this is an erotic thriller. Got it.
Especially because like, I'm also interested on the both of your thoughts on this as well, but to me, there's far more of an emphasis in the movie on their sexual connection and like their physical attraction than there is on like an actual like, what do they have in common? Why do they like each other?
Oh.
I didn't get a big sense of that, but also maybe I'm forgetting some stuff.
I do think, yeah, I think there is more emphasis on the sexual parts. I think with the emotional, like, aspect of it, the part that sticks out to me is, like, the time when Suki is destroying all the books and the, mm-hmm. and the paintings and whatnot. And she's, like, so angry because she understands, you know, what has been happening. She destroys everything. And the lady, Hideko, is just, you know, standing there just, like, not fully sure on what to do. She's just like, mm-hmm. oh, what is happening? I don't know. I feel like that, like, on an emotional level was, like, I don't know. I felt that. I was like, oh, that's really sweet because, you know, their worlds are colliding in this moment where it's, like, she kind of, like, is thinking, oh, I thought you were this rich girl who doesn't really understand anything, but it's like, no, you're victimized the way I'm victimized, mm-hmm. just in different aspects, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's kind of how the worlds collided.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah.
That's what I saw. That's a scene I remember.
Yeah. I felt a similar way where it, you know, it's, I guess that you learn more about their emotional connection in the back half where, like, part one definitely doesn't give you everything you need, but also part one gives you a completely false impression of who mm-hmm. Lady Hideko mm-hmm. is. Like, I feel like if we were just like, all my notes from part one was like, oh my gosh, like, Lady Hideko is on this, like, Born Sexy Yesterday thing going on and she's just like, I don't, what is sex? I've never heard of that. And you know, mm-hmm. and in a way that I thought, like, the movie had fun with later, where they kind of poke fun at Suki for being like, wow, this must just, you must have incredible instincts for being like,
yeah, you're a natural.
That made me laugh. But I thought that, I mean, I don't know. I felt like any relationship where they just surprised each other and, like, I don't know. I'm always, like, kind of a sucker for relationships like that. And it is, like, yeah. you know, kind of, like, definitely a class story we've seen before. Let's say Titanic,
right? Perchance.
Perhaps. But where you know, it's like they have very rigid ideas of who this person is going to be. And they end up getting surprised by that person having a lot more to them than they expected. So I was on board for the love story. I got why they were drawn to each other as people. And I think, you know, we definitely could have spent more time with it and with them as that relationship was building. But especially those, like, longer scenes in part one, when you reflect on them and you're like, oh, like, Lady Hideko is playing 4D chess and she knows exactly what's going on, and even mm-hmm. still she's, like, falling for Suki. I don't know, I was on board for the romance. I thought it was like a classic, you know, star-crossed lovers across classes kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah,
which is contrived in itself, but, like, whatever.
I think we could have shortened those sex scenes and given us, like, one or two more signifiers of just, like, oh, yeah, here's what they bond over. Here's a thing that they both like. Or here's a little thing that they have in common. Because I still don't have the strongest sense of that. And it's one thing, you know, if a movie wants to present this connection just as a sexual connection, like, obviously not every connection between people needs to be this deep, intimate, long-lasting love. But I feel like the movie frames their connection as deep love. So I don't know. But now I'm just picturing Titanic. If Titanic were, like, Billy Zane and Rose collaborating to trick Jack Dawson into something. But it turns out, wait a minute, Rose and Jack are collaborating to trick Billy Zane and get his fortune.
Everything remaps onto Titanic. It's just nature.
It's unavoidable.
Another something that I also, like, it's a trope we talked about a bajillion times, but relationships that are founded on lies. You know, that was something I was aware of very early in the movie, but again, I feel like this movie kind of, like, finds its way out of the trappings of that, where the lies are found out and they simply admit it and apologize to each other and then, like, take action in a positive direction, where I feel like, you know, we've covered 5 trillion movies at this point that is, like, there's a dare that involves a lie, and it makes sense, but not really. And then at the end, the, you know, the person lying, usually in this heterosexual relationship, is like Freddie Prinze Jr. And he's like, I don't know, I told a lie and I'm not even sorry. And then
I'm not
going to
apologize.
This movie, you know, like skirts all of those things where it is just everything is a lie at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then there's that great scene where Suki catches Lady Hideko and they have this just very emotionally raw conversation. They're both crying. They're both being honest. And then they single-handedly destroy the patriarchy at the end. Mm. So there you go.
Yeah. Also, I mean, they're both victims of this patriarchal structure. They're both... Mm-hmm. They have a lot of trauma that they have been subjected to. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense that they bond. Again, I wish there was just a smidge more.
There's also that moment that, I don't know, in the different, it makes me want to like watch it back again, because I feel like, this movie does like give you a lot back once you know what's going to happen in the middle. But even the ways that like their patriarchal structure influences their assumptions of each other, mm-hmm. where at the beginning, like Suki, we hear her talking in voiceover a lot, and she's talking about Lady Hideko as if she's an object at the beginning, and she's like, you know, ladies are handmaidens' dolls, and like she is you know, being encouraged to think of her in this very particular way, and being encouraged to think of her as, you know, someone who is not as smart as her. And then in the second half, we're being encouraged to think of Suki as someone who is not as smart as Lady Hideko, based on how she's been conditioned to view, you know, poor women and poor people in general. And then in the third part, you realize, guess what? Neither was true, and it was somewhere in the middle, and they're on a boat.
They're both geniuses.
They're both geniuses, and they're on a boat. I really liked Suki had this fun like Aladdin style introduction to who she was that I thought was very exciting, where I like the mythos of Suki's life, where she's like, I am the world's greatest thief, and I was like, oh my god, she's Aladdin, this is exciting. And she's, that was, I don't know if that has anything to do with anything, but I wrote down Suki equals Aladdin.
I mean, think? And she falls in love with her princess Jasmine. Hideko teaches Suki how to read. So women helping other women, women uplifting women. You love to see it.
Although reading for Hideko was a prison for a long time. She was taught to read for evil.
Yeah.
It's true.
And that's why we don't read books.
And that's why on the Bechdelcast we don't read books, because reading, actually, women reading is a prison.
It's dangerous. We've been saying this for years at this point. It's dangerous.
I mean, to call back to another Disney movie, according to Gaston in Beauty and the Beast, mm-hmm. women who read, it gives them ideas and then they start thinking. And that is dangerous.
It's dangerous.
Does anyone have anything else they would like to talk about?
That was all I had.
Yeah, same.
I just wanted to add, so there's, in the second half of the movie, there's a scene we've seen a couple times from two different points of view where Suki is like standing in as just like a model for the art, like the painting mm-hmm. that Hideko is doing of Suki. And you see a quick reveal of her drawing of Suki, and it's the funniest thing in the world because it's so bad.
It's really bad.
But they,
it's like what Leonardo DiCaprio was actually drawing in the Titanic scene, where he's like, circle, dot, dot, smile.
And you just get like the quickest glimpse of it, but... And it's not really played as a joke, but I burst out laughing every time I see it because it's so funny. Because first you see, so the Count's whole thing is that he's been training for years to be a forger. Mm-hmm. So he like he's a talented artist. Like, he's a really good artist. He's really good at creating these forgeries of these books and, like, the art in the books. So he knows what he's doing. And you see, like, his little sketches and paintings of Suki, and you're like, oh, damn, like, he's great. And then it pans over to Lady Hideko's drawing. It's the funniest thing in the world.
It's really bad. It's...
I guess the last serious thing I wanted to talk about, and I don't know a whole lot about Park Chan-wook's filmography. I've seen Old Boy, but it's been several years, so I don't remember it that well. So I don't really know much about him as a figure and sort of like his background and stuff like that. But one of his reasons for wanting to make this movie is that his intention was to normalize queer relationships in cinema. And, you know, that's not something that most straight male directors are concerned with. So
I feel like it's a classic step in the right direction kind of move, where we've talked about, I think, a lot of instances like this where the attempt is perhaps imperfect in some ways, but the endorsement of a, you know, super famous director, and mm-hmm. I mean, not even the endorsement, but like a super famous director prioritizing representation of queer people and of a lesbian relationship in their work is like a good step in the right direction. Does it mean that everything was represented perfectly and in a way that made total sense? Usually not in those cases, because most of these hotshot directors are normally straight men, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. therefore they're fucked in terms of their worldview. but it usually indicates, I feel like at least historically, it usually indicates that better movies and better representation is close behind, or I hope so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this movie being a success and critically acclaimed, mm-hmm. hopefully paves the way for queer women in South Korea to be able to tell their own stories next.
Let's hope so. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the movie does pass the Bechdel test.
Oh, hell yeah. A lot of women scheming. A lot of women lying to each other in a way that passes the Bechdel test.
And as far as our nipple scale, our scale of 0 to 5 nipples based on how the movie fares looking at it through the lens of intersectional feminism, I'm tempted to give this like a 4.25. Just the narrative that unfolds of ultimately like women teaming up to overthrow and manipulate their oppressors the way that they had been manipulating them, mm-hmm. and coming out on top, being allowed to like be together on this ferry, and then hopefully after that for however much time they want to spend together, if they live, you know, the rest of their lives together. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just like all the commentary on the patriarchy and the smashing of that patriarchy is just very satisfying and cathartic to watch. The sex scenes are pretty male gazey. They're pretty fetishy, a bit gratuitous, we'll say. You know, it always kind of begs the question, was this the right director to tell this story? Or, you know, like, is this the right person to be shooting these scenes? And, like, how much consultation was actually done, etc.?
Yeah.
So that's where the movie loses some points. So I think I'll land on a 4.25. That might be too generous, but I just think this movie rules, so I'm going to go easy on it. And I will give my nipples to Tae-ri Kim, who plays Suki, Min-hee Kim, who plays Hideko, the screenwriter, Jong Seo-kyun, and I'll give one to the aunt, a tragic fate.
Yeah.
And she deserves something. I'll give my quarter nipple to that amazing drawing.
I'm going to go When we get into the fractions, it gets so messy. I'm gonna go 3.75 because ultimately this movie is directed and shot by straight guys. So I don't want to go too much higher than that. That said, a period piece that has a female co-writer based on the work of a famous lesbian writer. It's a period piece where the lesbian couple stays together. It's a happy ending for them. We see their patriarchal structure, at least in the terms of the two of them, crumble and is very cool and very rare in terms of lesbian period pieces, unfortunately. So I think that that's definitely something worth praising. The movie itself fucking rocks. Like, if you haven't seen it, it's so fun. I wish I had watched it with someone else so we could have at all the right moments, but it's it's a really fun movie. It's very accessible if you have Amazon Prime. Hail Bezos. Sorry, we legally have to say that.
Our king.
we love our bald king. But I think that there are the sex scenes are male gazy and they are quite long, and there are, I don't know, I mean, this is sort of inherent to the kind of story that this is, but anytime it's like the patriarchy is two people and you know them, so if you can just get rid of these two people,
right,
you're free. Like, it's fun in a fantasy way, but I'm always just like, okay, but what about the rest of it?
Yeah, it's not so much smashing the patriarchy, it's more smashing men,
those two guys, you know. which is also very hard, but
true,
you know, whatever. I'm getting very in the weeds there. I guess, you know, I'll go for a four, but I can't go higher because when it's two straight guys, it's just like, okay, so this is a step, but more please. So I'll go four, and I'm giving them all to that GoPro. So yeah, what would you give it?
I think I'd give it a solid four because, you know, it's a good story. It's great that it exists in this world from, you know, Korea and stuff like that. But just, yeah, the sex scenes are so long. They're so long. And I was just like, it's too long. And we had to see multiple angles of it. And, you know, I feel like, you know, you could have shortened it just a little bit. Not like, you know, get rid of it, but shorten it. But, you know, I like the story being told in that time of the occupation. And, you know, their love. Actually, you know, happy ending. They both get to be together. You know, the men, they die. And everyone is happy who's alive. So I give it a solid four.
Hell yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
This was a blast.
This journey.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. Do you have anything you'd like to plug? Any social media or anything like that?
I do not. I do not have social media.
It's better that way.
Wow, our bravest guest yet. That is the healthiest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we're still on social media. You can find us at The Bechdelcast on Twitter and Instagram, or Bechdelcast on Twitter and Instagram. Oh my God. You can go to our Patreon, aka Matreon, at patreon.com/Bechdelcast. This month on the Patreon, we're doing movies that have animals in them. I forget why, but we are. If you want to hear episodes about Stuart Little and Babe the pig,
yep.
It's only $5 a month and you can hear whatever that is.
I mean, Jamie, it's famously Animal June. What are you talking about?
It's Animal June, which we've observed for many, many years.
Yeah. There's also our Tee Public store, teepublic.com/TheBechdelcast, where you can get all of your merchandising needs. And with that, I'm glad that we all stopped lying to each other and tricking each other.
Let's get on a boat to Shanghai. Let's get out of here.
Let's do it. Bye.
Bye.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring?
but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.